This is Audible.
You're listening to the audio production of The Magnolia Story by Chip and Joanna Gaines with Mark D'Agostino, published by Thomas Nelson and read by Chip and Joanna Gaines.
We would like to dedicate this book to our children, Drake, Ella Rose, Emmy Kay, and Duke, and to the children of Restoration Gateway. Our commitment to you will never fade. Blessings in a Big Ugly Disguise. I've always been one to play it safe. If it were up to me, the less risk involved, the better. But this isn't how the story goes, because I'm married to the one, the only, Chip Carter Gaines. One day back in early 2012, my husband decided to go window shopping online. That's always a risky thing to do, but when Chip's the man behind the mouse, it can be downright dangerous. I never know what object or animal might show up at my front door on the back of some random delivery truck. On this particular day, Chip happened to spot a used houseboat for sale. We'd been living in a house that we were getting ready to flip, and we'd just started renovating our farmhouse outside of Waco, Texas, which meant we were on the hunt for a temporary place to live. So Chip clicked through the pictures of that floating two-story shanty with its microscopic kitchen and had a full-blown Chip Gaines epiphany.
You know, I really thought to myself, how cool is this going to be? Move the entire family onto this houseboat. We'll put it down here on one of these lakes. I'll get the kids to fish for breakfast off of the balcony. Joe is going to love this.
So he bought it, sight unseen. We just barely had our heads above water at that point, and he went and threw tens of thousands of dollars down on that thing. And then he didn't say a word. He had it shipped to Waco on a monster tractor trailer and couldn't wait to show off the surprise when it finally arrived. After all our years of marriage, he was still clueless about how I might react. I had no idea any of this was going on, of course. But right around that same time, on some random weeknight, I received a phone call from an out-of-state number I didn't recognize. I picked it up. "Hi, I'm Katie Neff, and I work for a television production company," the woman on the line said. "I saw some of your designs online, and I was wondering..." This Katie had apparently seen photos of our most recent flip house that I designed, the one we were living in at the time. A few weeks earlier, a friend of mine, Molly, had submitted these photos to a popular blog called DesignMom.com, and I'd been excited that a blog with thousands of followers wanted to feature it. It was the first time my work had ever really been featured on a design blog other than my own. I had a loyal local following back then, but no national following to speak of. "I love what you did," Katie continued. "So I looked you up and read your blog, too. I see that you and your husband work together, and I was just wondering, would you ever want to be on a TV show?" I sat there and thought, did I just hear that right? "What about us would you want a show on TV?" I asked. "Well, we just love how organic it is, that you and your husband work together. Not only do you sell homes, but you also flip and renovate them. We think it's unique, and you're a husband and wife team." She went on, and I finally said, "Well, let me talk to Chip, and I'll get back with you." I got with Chip, and he immediately said, "That's a scam, JoJo. Don't call them back."
Yeah, I'll admit I was skeptical. You know, back in high school, I had these buddies who were always trying to get into modeling. Seems like they'd end up with an agent, some sort of a casting call. They'd wind up paying some guy thousands of dollars to get these headshots, and nothing would ever come of it. So yeah, I thought it was something like that. Joe really thought she was going to give this a shot. So I was like, "Joe, I'm telling you, there's no way this is legit. We're going to meet these people. They're going to get us all excited thinking we're going to be famous or something like that. And then they're going to say, oh, and by the way, you owe us $20,000.
I somehow convinced Chip to let me call Katie back. We didn't have a lot of money just lying around, so I knew there was no way anyone could trick us out of thousands of dollars. Of course, I knew nothing about that houseboat yet. Sure enough, within a couple of weeks, Katie sent an entire camera crew to Waco to spend 5 days filming us for what they called a sizzle reel, basically an extended commercial they would put together to try to sell a television series based on the two of us and our little business. They never asked us for any money at all. They were legit, which made us wonder, why in the world would anyone care to watch us on TV? We don't even watch TV. These people have to be nuts. After the crew spent a couple of days with us, they started thinking they may be nuts too. Chip and I were horrible. We were scared of the cameras, which is hilarious because Chip is the most talkative guy I know. But like clockwork, the moment that red light turned on, he froze.
My mouth was dry. I couldn't even think straight. Joe was her normal, slightly dull self. They just followed Joe around and tried to make something out of nothing. It was pretty obvious this could not make good television. We were awful. We were awful.
The crew had me stand in my kitchen and try to make pancakes with the kids hanging off my legs while Chip was basically sucking his thumb over in the corner. And the whole time I was trying to convince the kids not to look into the camera so it would look more natural. It certainly didn't feel natural, and it definitely wasn't any fun. On the fourth day, just before the camera crew was scheduled to go home, their top guy pulled us aside and said, "Look, if something doesn't happen here, there's no way you guys are getting a show. This just isn't working." We figured we were pretty much done at that point, and it didn't really bother us at all. The two of us had never imagined we'd be on TV. We talked to friends about the kinds of things they watched on reality TV, and from what we could tell, none of it seemed like us anyway. Then something happened. The very next morning, the houseboat arrived. With cameras rolling, Chip put a blindfold on me and drove me to an empty lot by the lake. With all cameras on me, Chip released the blindfold and said, "Ta-da!" I wasn't sure what I was looking at. A shipwreck, maybe? On the back of a semi? "What is that?" I said. "I got this for you, Joe," Chip replied. "That better not be for me," I said. It was the ugliest, run-down-looking, two-story shack of a boat I'd ever seen. "What the heck are we going to do with this houseboat?" "That's our new home," Chip said, beaming with pride at his purchase. "What? You are crazy. We are not living on a houseboat." It quickly dawned on me that this wasn't a joke, and Chip wasn't even close to kidding. I wasn't mishearing him. He was dead serious about making that boat our home for the next 6 months. I just about lost it. "How can we live on the water, Chip? Three of our kids don't even know how to swim. Did you think this through?" Then he fessed up and told me how much money he'd spent on it. As it all sank in, I realized I'd never been so mad at him. Ever. And that's saying something. "Come on. At least come look at it. I know this can work," he pleaded. As soon as we walked a little closer, we could see the holes. Holes. In the boat. We pulled ourselves up on the flatbed and went inside to find the interior covered in mold. Someone had taken the AC unit out on top and left a gaping hole in the roof, so for years it had rained straight into the boat. We tried turning the engine over, and of course it didn't start. That's when Chip got angry. "I think I got scammed," he said. "Chip, did you even look at this thing before you bought it?" "Well, no," he said. "It was a great deal, and there were all kinds of pictures. It looked like it was in great shape." "Oh, wait a minute. I bet the guy just put up pictures of this thing from when he bought it, like in 1980 or something. That sorry sucker." "Sorry sucker, Chip?" By this point, I'm trying to decide if we could scrap it for parts. My husband had made plenty of impulsive purchases. That's just what he does. He'd gone and purchased the house we were currently in without showing that to me either. But at least it was a house, with a roof, on a foundation. I'd gone along with it, as I always do, and over time I'd come to love that quirky shoebox of a house. We had worked hard to make it our home. In fact, that house is where I'd had my epiphany about truly owning the space you're in, a moment I'll share with you later, and where I designed the kids' rooms that landed on the blog and caused the producer to call. I was already pretty upset that we were going to have to leave the house behind in a few months, but to think that we might have to move into this thing was just too much. "You need to return it," I said. "It's paid for," Chip said. "It's done. I bought it as is." "Excuse me, semi-driver," I yelled at the man in the front seat. "I need you to hook that thing back up and take it back where it came from." Chip made it clear to me that once he made a deal, fair or not, that thing was ours now. By that point, the cameras had totally disappeared to both of us. We just completely forgot they were there. Chip's arms were flailing around as he circled the boat, tallying up the problems he could find. My arms were flailing as I yelled at him for buying that dumb thing without talking to me first. When I finally calmed down, I saw how disappointed he was and how bad he felt. I decided to take a deep breath and try to think this thing through. "Maybe it's not that bad," I said. I think I was trying to cheer myself up as much as I was trying to console Chip. "If we fix up the interior and just get it to the point where we can get it onto the water, at least maybe then we can turn around, sell it, and get our money back." Over the course of the next hour or so, I really started to come around. I took another walk through the boat and started to picture how we could make it livable, maybe even kind of cool. After all, we'd conquered worse. We tore a few things apart right then and there, and I grabbed some paper and sketched out a new layout for the tiny kitchen. I talked to him about potentially finishing an accent wall with shiplap, a kind of rough textured pine paneling that fans of our show now know all too well. "Shiplap?" Chip laughed. That seems a little ironic to use on a ship, doesn't it? Ha ha, I replied. I was still not in the mood for his jokes, but this is how Chip backs me off the ledge with his humor. Then I asked him to help me lift something on the deck, and he said, "Aye, aye, matey," in his best pirate voice, and slowly but surely, I came around. I can't believe I'm saying this, but by the end of that afternoon, I was actually a little bit excited about taking on such a big challenge. Chip was still deflated that he'd allowed himself to get duped, but he put his arm around me as we started walking back to the truck. I put my head on his shoulder, and the cameras captured the whole thing. Just an average roller coaster afternoon in the lives of Chip and Joanna Gaines. The head cameraman came jogging over to us before we drove away. Chip rolled down his window, and he said sarcastically, "How's that for reality TV?" We were both feeling embarrassed that this is how we had spent our last day of trying to get this stinking television show. "Well," the guy said, breaking into a great big smile, "if I do my job, you two just landed yourself a reality television show." What? We were floored. We couldn't believe it. How was that a show? But lo and behold, he was right. That rotten houseboat turned out to be a blessing in disguise. Over the course of the next 5 months, the production company's head of development, Patrick Jaeger, championed our show tirelessly until HGTV decided we were just what they wanted. Apparently, one of the big selling points was the authenticity we'd shown during that humbling afternoon. We couldn't have scripted it even if we tried. There was something about Chip's impulsiveness, his riskiness, combined with my reaction to his riskiness, and the way we worked it out as a couple that landed us the show. A few months later, the cameras were back, and Fixer Upper was born. Our quiet little lives turned completely upside down as our life's work became a hit TV show. After years of toiling away, semi-anonymously here in Waco, trying to make ends meet while designing our clients' dream homes and doing our best to raise our four kids right, our world changed in a way that was much different than either of us could have ever imagined. Now that we've had some time to reflect on it, it's as if our whole lives have been preparing us for this experience. We didn't know it at the time, but it's as if the seeds have been planted long ago. Have you ever looked at the bud of a magnolia flower? It's a tight little pod that stays closed up for a long time on the end of its branch until one day, out of nowhere, it finally bursts open into this gigantic, gorgeous, fragrant flower that's 10 times bigger than the bud itself. It's impossible to imagine that such a big, beautiful thing could pop out of that tiny little bud. But it does. And that's sort of what getting discovered and sharing our lives on Fixer Upper feels like to us. We never could have imagined being on TV together, touching the lives of so many people, especially back when we were two broke newlyweds sleeping on the floor of our 800-square-foot house while we renovated it, or when I first opened and then I had to close my little magnolia shop on Bosque Boulevard. I have to wonder, though, if it was just a happy coincidence that we decided to name that shop Magnolia. Or was it something more? Because it's staggering to think just how much it has blossomed. As we finished up writing this book, HGTV was airing the third season of Fixer Upper, and we'd started filming seasons 4 and 5. And that's only part of the excitement. Thanks to the show's popularity, we outgrew our beloved little shop on Bosque. In 2015, to make room for all of our new customers, we moved the shop into a converted early 20th century cotton oil mill. Our new property is marked by two giant, rusty, abandoned silos in the heart of downtown Waco, easy to spot from miles away. It's a place where we're proud to welcome our out-of-town visitors. To get how exciting this is for us, you have to understand where it all started. A little shop, one employee, and a shop girl who is happy to see 8 customers a day. The reality that thousands of visitors are coming to our town to experience Magnolia Market at the silos is not only an honor, it's one of the single greatest accomplishments of our careers. We've also had the great thrill of seeing our friends' businesses boom since we've gotten to incorporate their work and artistry into the shop and show. That was our goal from the beginning, to bless our community, our friends, and our viewers through this unbelievable platform we've been given. Chip and I have received generous opportunities to speak all over the country, to give DIY tips on talk shows, to design our own furniture, rug, and paint lines, and now to write a book. A book! Can you believe it? For the two of us, writing these pages has offered a welcome chance to stop and look back on the story of our lives, and it certainly has been an eye-opening process. How many of us take the time to relive half a lifetime's worth of happy memories, cringeworthy failures, and unforgettable adventures together? How many of us get a chance to sit down and talk about the rough times we overcame in the past or to laugh about the stupid mistakes we made when we were young. Working on this book has allowed us to look back on all the things that brought us here to the farm, to this place we love so much, and to this busy, exciting season in our lives. And let me tell you, it's been one heck of a journey. We're still trying to figure out how to make this new life work for us and our kids, smack dab in the middle of these exciting new adventures we've been on. Writing it all down has also allowed us to reflect on the inspiration we've picked up and the lessons we've learned along the way. And there have been many. We feel so blessed to be able to share all of this with you in the hope that you'll find new ways to love the space and season you're in too. Even after all of this thinking and talking and writing, Chip and I still look at each other at the end of the day and say, "Us? Really?" Honestly, we're still pretty baffled as to why people seem to like watching the two of us be us on national TV, because these are the same old things we've been doing since the very day we met. But that's a story for another chapter. 1. First dates and second chances. To this day, I am still not sure what it was about Chip Gaines that made me give him a second chance, because basically our first date was over before it even started. I was working at my father's Firestone Automotive shop the day we first met. I'd worked as my dad's office manager through my years at Baylor University and was perfectly happy working there afterward while I tried to figure out what I really wanted to do with my life. The smell of tires, metal, and grease, that place was like a second home to me, and the guys in the shop were all like my big brothers. On this particular afternoon, they all started teasing me. "You should go out to the lobby, Joe. There's a hot guy out there. Go talk to him," they said. "No," I said. "Stop. I'm not going to do that." I was all of 23, and I wasn't exactly outgoing.
She was a bit awkward. There's no doubt about that.
I hadn't dated all that much, and I'd never really had a serious relationship, nothing that lasted longer than a month or two. I'd always been an introvert, and still am, believe it or not. I was also very picky, and I just wasn't the type of girl who struck up conversations with guys I didn't know. I was honestly comfortable being single. I didn't think that much of it. "Who is this guy, anyway?" I asked, since all of them seemed to know him for some reason. "Oh, they call him Hot John," someone said, laughing. Hot John? There's no way I was going to go out in the lobby to strike up a conversation with some guy called Hot John, but the guys wouldn't let up, so I finally said, "Fine." I gathered up a few things from my desk, in case I needed a backup plan, and rounded the corner into the lobby. I quickly realized that Hot John was pretty good looking. He'd obviously just finished a workout, he was dressed head to toe in cycling gear, and was just standing there, innocently waiting on someone from the back. I tried to think about what I might say to strike up a conversation when I got close enough, and quickly settled on the obvious topic, cycling. But just as that thought raced through my head, he looked up from his magazine and smiled right at me. Crap, I thought. I completely lost my nerve. I kept on walking right past him and out the lobby's front door. When I reached the safety of my dad's outdoor waiting area, I realized just how bad I needed the fresh air. I sat on a chair a few down from another customer and immediately started laughing at myself. Did I really just do that? "Hey, what's so funny?" the customer sitting near me asked. I looked up at him, and before I could even answer, he asked, "Wait, aren't you the girl from the commercials?" "Yeah, that's me," I said, still embarrassed for my awkward encounter with Hot John. I was, in fact, the girl from the commercials. I had some interest in television news. I'd even done an internship with CBS in New York City, working under Dan Rather in the news division. And because of that, my dad had insisted I go on camera for the local TV ads he ran for his shop. I was so caught up in my own thoughts that I didn't even get a good look at this guy who had started talking to me. He was wearing a baseball cap and seemed like an average customer. He seemed around my age, maybe a bit older. That was all I really noticed. What did strike me was that he was real chatty, so we wound up sitting there for 20 minutes just shooting the breeze. Over the course of our conversation, he told me he was a Baylor grad. That struck me as odd. The guys I'd known at Baylor were more the clean-cut type. This guy seemed a little rough and tumble, the kind who'd rather work with his hands than keep a corporate calendar. But right off the bat, I could tell he was smart and definitely hardworking. He was just at the shop getting the brakes fixed on his truck. I also found it interesting that he'd stuck around Waco after graduation. "I love this town," he said. "I'm planning to stay in Waco until God makes it clear I'm supposed to move on." That surprised me, too. I love the way he mentioned God in a way that was so unguarded, and I like that he wanted to stay in Waco. That was rare for Baylor grads. Normally, people ship themselves straight off to the big cities after graduation. Speaking of, that whole week I had been debating whether or not to move back to New York City to pursue my dream of broadcast journalism. Most of my friends and family were encouraging me to go, and I was really wrestling with it. It occurred to me that this could be my one big chance, but I also really liked it right here where I was. All of a sudden, Hot John walked out and said, "Hey, Chip, let's go." I was confused. The man I'd been chatting with, who apparently was named Chip, explained that John was his roommate and that the two of them were business partners. Oh, of course these two had come together. I was still completely embarrassed about my initial encounter with Hot John. But I said, "Hi," and then thankfully this Chip went right back to our conversation as Hot John took a seat and joined in. Chip asked me about New York and what I wanted to do and how long my dad had owned the shop and what it was I loved about Waco. He asked about my sisters and my family in general and what I'd done at Baylor and if I'd known a few communication majors he'd run around with at school. I told y'all he was chatty. Somehow none of these questions seemed intrusive or strange to me at the time, which is funny because thinking back, I find them particularly telling. At the time, it was just like talking with an old friend. John finally stood up and this baseball cap wearing customer that John had introduced as Chip followed. "Well, nice talking to you," he said. "Nice talking to you too," I replied, and that was it. I went back inside. The guys in the shop wanted to know what I thought about Hot John, and I just laughed. "Sorry, guys, I don't think it's going to work out." The next day, I came back for my lunch break to find a note on my desk. "Chip Gaines called. Call him back." I thought, oh, well, that must be the guy I met yesterday. So I called him. I honestly thought he was going to ask me about getting a better price on his brakes or something, but instead he said, "Hey, I really enjoyed our conversation yesterday. I was wondering, you want to go out sometime?" And for some reason, I said, okay, just like that, without any hesitation. It wasn't like me at all. When I hung up the phone, I went, what in the world just happened?
So you said okay immediately? I don't remember it like that. That's fun. No reservations. I must have been good looking.
What Chip didn't know was I didn't even give myself time to have reservations. Something told me to just go for it.
Cute, Joey. The story makes me love you all over again.
My parents were out of town that week, but I remember calling to tell them. I'm going on a date with a customer that was getting his brakes done. I met him yesterday. I guess it's unusual for a 23-year-old to call her parents and tell them she's going on a date, but it was normal for me. I was extremely close to my parents, and I was just excited to tell them. My parents and my little sister, Mary Kay, whom I call Mikey, asked me what this Chip guy looked like. And I said, I honestly can't tell you. He had a baseball cap on, and the way we were sitting, I didn't really get a good look at him. When the night of our big date came, I was giddy and a bit anxious. I got ready at my sister's apartment. She and her roommates, Sarah and Katie, were all there for moral support, and Chip was supposed to pick me up at 6. 6 rolls around, no Chip. Then 6:30, still no Chip. I thought, well, maybe he thought the date was at 7, so I gave him the benefit of the doubt. But when 7 came and went, I was officially done. Finally, at 7:30, a full 90 minutes later, he knocked at the door. "Don't even answer it," I whispered to my friends. "I don't want to go anywhere with this idiot." "But we want to see what he looks like," they said. And so one of them finally opened the door while I hung back out of sight. "Well, hello, ladies," Chip said as he pushed his way into the apartment. I could tell that he charmed every one of them in about 2 seconds flat. I finally decided to step out and at least take a look at him. He was not like I remembered at all. This guy had no hair. I'd imagine he had hair under the baseball cap, but nope, just stubble. And his face was weathered and flushed red like he'd been working outside in the hot sun all day long. He was wearing a reddish tone leather jacket too. And I thought, is this red guy the same guy I was talking to at the shop? It turned out that Chip had shaved his head to support a friend of his who was battling cancer.
Yeah, a bunch of us had gotten together. We all shaved our heads for this good friend of mine. It was growing back, but it was not quite past the buzz cut at this point.
I still don't remember what he said that convinced me to walk out the door with him. He didn't even have a plan for our date. He said, "So, Joanna, where do you want to go eat?" He didn't even apologize for being late either. He had so much confidence. I don't know. I can't explain it. Only Chip can be an hour and a half late and have no one mad about it.
I wasn't an hour and a half late. She's making that up. I was like maybe 15 or 20 minutes late, max.
Chip was an hour and a half late to everything. If I'd known that then, maybe I wouldn't have taken it personally.
Well, I think you're wrong about that. You're definitely cute, though, and you do have me on the no plans thing. That was bad. I don't even know what I was thinking. I just never had any plans. I liked the way things were when they would work themselves out. It seemed to be more fun that way. I wasn't nervous about the date or where to eat, and I certainly wasn't nervous about being late.
Out in his truck, Chip asked me again where I'd like to eat. So I suggested a place out in Valley Mills, a small town about 30 minutes from Waco, which looking back was a gutsy move for a first date. 30 minutes was a long time to be in a car if you ran out of things to talk about. But there was a restaurant there in a historic mansion where my parents liked to go. It was really charming, and it was the first place that popped into my head.
The whole drive over there was kind of like a dream for me. Joe wasn't anything like the girls I'd typically went out with. She was definitely cute, you know. We wound up driving out of town through these backwoods roads. I didn't even know where in the heck we were going. We came up to this mansion with these gorgeous pillars in the front. Looked like something you'd see out of Gone with the Wind. Everything was going about like I'd expect until we sat down at this table and the owner of the restaurant came over. Everywhere I went in Dallas or Waco, somebody always came up, knew me, talking to me. So I thought, maybe this guy was coming over to say hi. Turns out, he wasn't coming to talk to me at all. He was coming over here to talk to Joanna. "Hey, sweetheart, how you doing?" he said. "I saw your latest commercial. Tell your mom and dad I said hello, okay?" They talked for quite a while, and my mind started turning like, wow. What is this girl, a local superstar?
Dinner was perfect. We were both comfortable with each other for some reason, and the conversation came easy. When the bill came, Chip quickly popped up and took a big roll of cash out of his pocket. I don't think I'd ever seen anyone carry that much cash. My dad was successful, but he kept his money in a bank. Seeing that, I thought, oh, that's why he stayed in Waco. He's doing really well for himself.
You thought I was rich? What you didn't know was that was probably all the money I had in the world. I always carried cash. I liked to carry like $1,000 at a time on me in those days. I just loved the way it felt. Plus, I worked with a lot of rough dudes, and sometimes these guys expected to be paid in cash. It's funny because I went to Baylor, where I was surrounded by all these rich kids from these rich, beautiful families. And for whatever reason, I was never really drawn to that. I was always more comfortable hanging out with the guys who dug ditches. You know, I lived like them too, whether it was carrying around all the money I had in the world in my pocket or sitting under some shade tree at lunchtime while they all laughed at me while I was trying to eat jalapenos.
After dinner, the two of us went and sat on that grand front porch for a while. It was a beautiful night, and I could have just sat there and listened to the silence. But Chip, of course, he had other ideas. I just looked at him until I couldn't even hear him anymore. I remember thinking, nope, this guy isn't even close to done. In my head, I started to go down the checklist we women put together in our heads and our hearts. I'd always been attracted to people with dark hair. He was blonde or redheaded or something in between. It was too short to tell. I would have preferred hair, period. I'd always been attracted to quiet guys, too, which I knew was a problem because the quiet guys never had the nerve to ask me out, and they certainly never drew me out the way this guy did. Still, he was all over the place. He was talking about the businesses he started and those ideas he had and how he was buying up little houses and flipping them and renting some out to Baylor students, and I was wondering if this guy was just a bit crazy. I like stability. I like safety. I like traditional, and I like being on time. And this guy with this beet red face wasn't any of those things. I did think he was kind of fascinating, though. I know this is going to sound strange to some people, but right in the middle of that, right in the middle of me trying to figure this guy out, a little voice in my head said, "That's the man you're going to marry." I swear to you, it was as clear as day. It seemed like the voice of God, or maybe it was some deep intuition, but I heard it. In fact, I heard it so loudly that I completely tuned out our conversation and lost focus. My roommates asked me a million questions after he dropped me off that night. What was he like? Did he try to kiss you? How was the date? And my response was that it was good, we had fun, he was a good talker, and no, he didn't try to kiss me. I didn't tell them about that voice in my head. It seemed far too ridiculous. But honestly, if it wasn't for that voice, I'm not sure I would have stuck it out through all the ups and downs of dating a guy like Chip. I was spinning a bit, but I certainly didn't fall instantly head over heels for him or anything like that.
It wasn't exactly love at first sight for me either. You know, I mean, it was a fun date, but I'd been on a lot of fun dates. Something was different, though. Joanna really impressed me. I couldn't stop thinking about that owner coming over and talking to her. I honestly was the one who normally got the attention. She was totally different from the typical blonde-haired, blue-eyed cheerleader type that I'd usually dated. But the more I thought about her, the more I knew I definitely wanted to see her again.
We made plans to go get coffee the following week, but I had to cancel. I hurt my back. In fact, I needed to go into the hospital for surgery, and I let Chip know that. He seemed real concerned and wished me luck, and then he didn't call me again. He didn't send flowers to the hospital, nothing.
Flowers to the hospital? After one date?
Yes. That would have been the chivalrous thing to do. Everyone thought it was rude that you didn't call after that.
Huh. Well, I mean, I definitely apologize. I didn't even think about that.
It's okay. I forgive you. I think it turned out okay in the end. Even though he wasn't what I'd pictured as the type of man I might be interested in, there was just something about Chip Gaines I couldn't get off my mind. I kept thinking about him and thinking about just how weird it all was. Our first date happened at the end of October, and it wasn't until after the turn of the new year, early January something, that I finally got another phone call from him. Hey, Joe, I just wanted to say that I really enjoyed our date, and I think we ought to stop playing all these games, he said. I was just sitting there thinking, what games is this guy talking about?
I'd made a bet with Hot John to see who could hold out the longest before we'd call our dates back. I really wanted that $50 from John. That's the only reason I didn't call.
I think Chip was still dating a few girls off and on then.
Yeah, I'm sure you're right about that. But I did want to win that $50. And it was killing me because I kept thinking about you and I kept thinking to myself, she's going to call any day now.
There's a basketball game tonight. Would you like to go? Chip asked me. Once again, without hesitation, I said yes. And from that night on, Chip and I started seeing each other almost every day. He would come by the tire shop to visit. He met my parents. I met his parents. I went out and drove around with him to see some of the properties he'd worked on and to meet some of the guys he'd worked with in his landscaping business. One guy, Malesio, was like a brother to Chip. I had never seen someone bond so closely to the people he worked with. After a while, I even offered to help him do some of the books for the little business he was running, and he took me up on it. I'd never been around that kind of work before, but I thought it was fun. I thought he was fun. About 4 months into it, we were shooting hoops in my dad's driveway when Chip stopped in his tracks, held me in his arms, looked into my eyes under the starry sky, and said, I love you. And I looked at him and said, thank you. Thank you? Chip said. I know I should have said, I love you too, but this whole thing had been such a whirlwind, and I was just trying to process it all. No guy had ever told me he loved me before, and here Chip was saying it after what seemed like such a short period of time. Chip got angry. He grabbed his basketball from under my arm and went storming off with it like a 4-year-old.
I really thought, what in the world is wrong with this girl? I just told her I loved her, and that's all she's got to say? I didn't throw those words around lightly, either. It's not like I run around saying that to everyone. So I'm saying it was a big deal for me, too. But now I'm stomping down the driveway, going, okay, that's it. I feel like I'm dating an emotionless cyborg or something like that. I'm going home.
Chip took off in his big white Chevy truck with Z71 stickers on the side, even squealing his tires a bit as he drove off, and it really sank in what a big deal that must have been for him. I felt bad, so bad that I actually got up the courage to call him later that night. I explained myself, and he said he understood, and by the end of the phone call, we were right back to being ourselves. 2 weeks later, when Chip said, I love you, again, I responded, I love you too. There was no hesitation. I knew I loved him, and I knew it was okay to say so. I'm not sure why I ever gave him a second chance when he showed up 90 minutes late for our first date, or why I gave him a second chance when he didn't call me for 2 months after that. And I'm not sure why he gave me a second chance after I blew that romantic moment in the driveway. But I'm very glad I did, and I'm very glad he did too, because sometimes second chances lead to great things. All of my doubts, all of the things I thought I wanted out of a relationship, and many of the things I thought I wanted out of life itself turned out to just be plain wrong. Instead, that voice from our first date turned out to be the thing that was absolutely right. 2. New directions. The first year Chip and I dated turned out to be my year of letting go. Letting go of the notion that my life was going to be predictable in any way, shape, or form. By his mid-20s, Chip had already been through a whole series of different businesses. Every time I thought I'd heard it all, he would tell me about something else he'd done to earn a buck.
Like in college, I sold these Scantron forms. Those things with these answer cards that you use when filling out certain types of tests. The teachers were able to run them through the machines, and that sort of sped up the grading process. Students at Baylor had to buy these Scantrons and bring them with them to class, but hardly anyone ever remembered to do that. So before the test, the teacher would sit down up front and say, whoever didn't bring their Scantron two-thirds of the class would raise their hand. She would sell them these Scantron forms for about $2 apiece. This was kind of a slap on the wrist to say, because at the bookstore, they only cost about a dime each. So I went to the bookstore, and I bought a whole bunch of these things, and the next time she offered to sell some, I stood up and said, "Mine are only a dollar." I had so many people buy a Scantron that day, I walked out feeling pretty good about myself. After all, I was a business major. I thought that move should have earned me an instant A. I also sold books for a company called Southwestern Book Company for 2 summers in college. It was a program where you were sent to a town, usually pretty far away from home. Your first objective was to convince people that you'd never met before to put you up for the summer, for free. And then you'd walk around this town selling books door to door. I'm telling you, that job changed my perspective as a college student. If you sold a lot of books, you could make a lot of money. And because of the setup, you had really low overhead. The downside was that it was a ton of work and it was really far from home. Most kids weren't willing to do any of that. I only spent about $3 a day on a sandwich and some eggs. So all of the money that I made literally went into my pocket. If I'd been a lifeguard or maybe waited tables over the summer, I would have wound up going out with all my buddies and spending half the money that I was making. But doing that program was almost like being sent to an island somewhere where all you did was literally work and sleep. And I got really good at it. I remember reading about work on these Alaskan fishing boats, where if things turned out, you could earn north of $6,000 a month. It was grueling, sometimes potentially dangerous stuff, but with no overhead, the money literally was all yours. These were the kind of things I'd sit and think about while I was in class. I realized most people don't want to do a lot of things that it takes to do that kind of work. I made up my mind right then and there, I would do whatever it took to be successful. The second summer, in the middle of selling books, I went to East Texas to open up a fireworks stand. You can only sell fireworks in Texas during this 2-week period before 4th of July. So I took the money I earned from half a summer's worth of selling books, and I bought the fireworks stand inventory. This probably seemed like a boneheaded move to my parents, but I'd heard there was really good money in it. My friend Eric and I went in on these stands together, and it was not easy, no doubt about that, but I earned a ton of money. It was like my first experience with investing. I did that the next 2 summers as well, opening 3 or 4 stands in East Texas. And my friend's uncle, whom I refer to as Uncle Ricky, played a huge role in all of that. From selling books, I knew and enjoyed hard work and the thrill of selling. But it was Uncle Ricky who really recognized the entrepreneur in me and encouraged me to follow that dream. There was something about the way Ricky would say, "Chip, you can do this." That made me believe I really could do it. He really believed in me and kind of trained me to some extent about simple business practices like paying taxes, understanding asset versus liabilities. I took all that experience and I used it to open up a lawn mowing business, which quickly expanded into a full landscaping business with employees, equipment, clients. Then I got the idea to buy some cheap properties on 3rd Street in Waco. On the other side of the track for sure, but within a mile or so of Baylor campus, so I could rent them out to incoming college students. Man, I was rocking and rolling. I certainly wasn't inventing Facebook or anything like that, but I was definitely what you would call a serial entrepreneur.
Chip's experimentation with lots of different kinds of businesses had eventually evolved into flipping houses. By the time we met, he'd successfully done it for a few years. Flipping seemed to be his thing. I have to say, it quickly became my favorite venture of his, too. When explaining to my friends and family what Chip did, I was always a little at a loss. He wasn't a realtor. At least people would have been able to understand that. And I'd never known a career could be made out of buying and selling houses. So even though I spent a lot of my time with Chip kind of playing catch-up to understand it all, it was exciting to me. As I said before, Chip was a smart guy. Unconventional, maybe, but he always had the entrepreneurial spirit and business sense to back it up. I was intrigued by this lifestyle of his, maybe because it was wildly different from the safe world I grew up in. Every day seemed to bring a new adventure, because Chip really did refuse to be put in the 9-to-5 box people filed themselves into after college graduation. Even when things got complicated, Chip remained fearless. It seemed as if nothing could stop him, and I was hooked. I think that's why, when we were first dating in our 20s, we were doing things most people our age weren't doing. Before he'd ever graduated from college, Chip had already figured out the game. Banking, negotiations, selling, all of it. Most people in college are studying and dating, and Chip was certainly doing his fair share of that, but mostly he spent his time thinking, what's the next business I can get into? In that regard, he was kind of a step ahead of a lot of our peers. By the time I started helping him with his properties, Chip was known as the unofficial mayor of Third Street. He owned a bunch of tiny little houses along this stretch of road that was also home to a school for troubled youth. Before he came in and fixed up some of the old houses to rent to Baylor students, a lot of people in Waco just steered clear of Third Street. But Chip was his fearless self and saw the area as a spot full of underpriced properties with potential. The kids at the school were young, and there was something about that age group that made Chip think he still had time to make a difference. He would cruise up and down that street on his four-wheeler, checking on the progress at various properties and checking in to make sure the tenants didn't need anything. And when he saw those kids walking by after school, he'd get into conversations and joke around with them. He wound up convincing a few of those kids to help out doing lawns and odd jobs on the properties he owned, and he paid them well, which ended up making him a pretty popular guy with them. It seemed that every time he'd give one a job, four more would show up the next day, ready to earn a little money. It was inspiring to watch him work and see how well he got along with everyone from his crew, to his clients, to those kids, to Uncle Ricky, whom he introduced me to early on. An interesting side note, Ricky and his wife made a hobby of importing antiques from Europe. They turned their little backyard into an absolute oasis full of old metal and wooden architectural pieces that he built into the landscape. And every time we went over there, the backyard had some new feature added to it. It was like walking from an ordinary Texas front porch into an exotic vacation every time you walked out the back door. I remember thinking, even back then, I would love to do something like that someday. So when Chip asked me to help him out that first summer we were dating, as he repainted and generally got his properties fixed up before the new Baylor students arrived in the fall, I was happy to do it. I didn't know anything about interior design or construction. I'd been a communications major, but I was more than content being his gopher.
To be honest with you, I didn't know any more about interior design or construction than Joe did. I learned this literally on the fly. If I needed to put a fence in or anything like that for that matter, I would just figure out how to do it, get my hands dirty, and figure it out. Everything I did was sort of that way. That was the story of my life.
I was still working at my dad's shop, too, but it was fun for me to see Chip's collection of little houses get all cleaned up. I liked thinking about the students who would soon be living in them and remembering what it felt like when I moved into my first apartment. I wanted to make sure everything was right for those kids. Most of the houses weren't much bigger than 800 square feet, so there wasn't a lot to work with. But I quickly saw how new carpet or a fresh paint color could change the whole atmosphere in a house that small. I liked the feeling of getting these jobs done and then watching the way those kids and their parents would go nuts as they were moving in. There was something rewarding about that kind of work. Even if it was something as simple as painting one room, each project had a beginning, middle, and end. You could stand back and actually see what you'd accomplished at the end of the day, and there was something very satisfying in that for me. On top of how much fun it was just to watch Chip do his thing and try to imagine what he might do next. It was more than just business. With Chip, it was everything. He was wild at heart, really. If you'd ever try to give him a rule, he would break it. If you gave Chip a boundary, he would cross it. Chip was just Chip. There was no box for this guy.
There's this movie, it's called Legends of the Fall, where this character named Tristan goes off into these wild places. I've always thought of myself in that kind of way.
And, case in point, the things that would come out of his mouth were unlike anything anyone else would ever think to say. Sometimes it would take me a second to figure out whether he was joking or drop-dead serious. He kept me on my toes, and I liked it. Chip was also extremely kind and giving. I swear every time we'd see a homeless guy, Chip would stop and talk to him. Sometimes he'd give him money. Sometimes he'd give him a job the next day. Heck, if the weather was bad, he'd even put him up in a hotel. We'd be walking downtown, and I'd hear, "Chip! Hey, Chip!" And I'd turn to see a person approaching us who, frankly, might have scared me if I was walking downtown by myself. Chip wouldn't be scared. He'd know the guy by name. "James, how's it going, brother?" It seemed as if every homeless guy in Waco knew Chip Gaines. On the flip side, every banker in Waco knew Chip too, and he talked to those two very different groups of people exactly the same way. There was never any difference in Chip's demeanor. His enthusiasm for life and work and people was just infectious, and he surprised me with it again and again. At least once a day I caught myself thinking, "Wow, this guy." Best of all, as happy as Chip Gaines was, he seemed happiest around me.
I'm a generally happy person. My mom always jokes that I was a happy baby. But it's a fact. I was always the happiest around Joe. And I think I still am.
One pretty amazing thing that we learned early on was that the more time we spent together, the better our relationship was. I think a lot of couples feel the need to get away from each other every now and then to take little breaks, and they came back after a girl's weekend or a guy's fishing trip or something, all refreshed and happy to reconnect because they missed each other. We were just the opposite, and still are. We seem to give each other energy. We function better together than we do apart, and I don't think either one of us have ever felt the urge to say, I need a break from you. Don't get me wrong. We've certainly had our share of disappointment and arguments, but we just always wanted to tackle our issues together. The two of us never talked about marriage during the first year we were together, but I knew pretty quickly that we were in this for the long haul, and I almost had to convince myself that it was okay to be in love with this man. I kept reminding myself, with Chip, my life isn't going to look like what I thought it was going to look like, but there will be adventure and there will be some fun. My parents were the type of people who locked their doors and had an alarm system. For my whole life, they encouraged me to go after what I wanted, to get a good education, even to go to New York for that internship. But they also encouraged me to use caution, and I did. Chip was the polar opposite. For example, whenever we went out shopping or to restaurants, he would leave his keys in the car. Who leaves their keys in the car in today's world? It was a real problem for us for a while because my first instinct when I got out of the car was to lock the doors. So we'd come back after dinner and realize I'd locked Chip's keys in the car again.
I remember that. In college, I wouldn't just leave my keys in the car. Literally, I would forget and leave it running. What's ironic about Joe and my parents is Joe's parents were pretty much hippies in their younger years. Her dad served in Vietnam, and he was this tall, quiet, lanky guy with glasses. Now, her mom was this vivacious Korean woman who just loved life. They both have the best stories. When I first saw pictures of the two of them before Joe was born, they looked like John Lennon and Yoko Ono. They were right in the thick of all that went on during the 60s. But despite that youthful rebellion, they turned out to be kind of cautious parents who were concerned with traditions and playing it safe. My parents both grew up in a little bitty town called Archer City, Texas, and they were straight as an arrow. But when they left the garage, they left it open, and I mean all day, even when they were out. They wouldn't even think about locking doors. My mom saw an upside to everything, and I think that's part of what made me so optimistic and adventuresome. I have to say, I was very thankful that Joe's parents were all right with us being together. They could have said, this guy is not going to work and you need to move in a different direction. And honestly, Joe was so obedient that just for the sake of responsibility or obligation or whatever you want to call it, she might have broken it off. But her parents, even early on, were so supportive and encouraging. And my parents were, of course, supportive of her. They still say to this day, she is the best thing that ever happened to me.
Despite all the differences between my dad and Chip, Dad knew that he had a good heart, and he saw something in Chip that he knew was right for me. People say opposites attract, and I think the fact that Chip and I were together for anything beyond a first date proves that point pretty well. But the fact that we stayed together goes to something a little deeper. The fact that we were opposites on the surface didn't negate the fact that we both were raised by loving parents and loving families, and that we both love our families dearly. Our roots were important to both of us, and that one common bond, to me, plays a big role in what has kept us together.
Not that we're perfect in any way. I mean, don't get the wrong idea. There were times when we would fight like cats and dogs, and Joe's tough, but there was just something about her. We'd always work through it. Whatever stupid mistakes I made, and there were plenty of stupid things that set her off, we'd find a way to get through it, and we'd wind up being even closer to each other than we had at the beginning, every single time. Joe was more perfect for me than I ever could have imagined. After we'd been dating about a year or so, I honestly couldn't imagine my life without her. So I decided to do the traditional thing, and I went and asked Joe's mom and dad for her hand in marriage. Honestly, that was one of the best days of my life. I couldn't have been more nervous, and they could not have been more supportive. And as soon as I was over that hurdle, I started planning a way to surprise her and ask her to marry me in a way that she'd never forget.
Chip told me he'd been invited to a private concert, and he asked me if I wanted to go. He was vague about what kind of music it was or what this concert was all about, but I didn't care. I pretty much wanted to go anywhere Chip wanted to take me. Okay, great, he said. Well, you've got to get really dressed up, and it's in Archer City. I knew that both of Chip's parents had gone to high school in that sweet little town, which was the setting for Larry McMurtry's famous novel, The Last Picture Show, and the movie of the same name starring Sybil Shepherd and Jeff Bridges. The old theater that inspired the book and film was still there, and I knew they had concerts in that venue from time to time, so nothing seemed unusual about Chip's request, even though we would have to drive 4 hours to get there. I honestly didn't suspect a thing. I was just excited. We wound up rolling into Archer City at about 7 o'clock that night, but instead of pulling up near the theater, Chip pulled into this little shopping center and drove us around to a door in the back. "Chip, where are you taking me?" I asked. "Just come on," he said. He was all smiles. I was thinking, well, this must be a super private concert. He took me into this unmarked hallway, and at first he seemed like he was lost, as if he was trying to figure out where he was going. Then all of a sudden, Chip fell down to one knee and sort of wobbled to one side. I thought he was having a heart attack or something. "Chip, are you okay?" I said.
I was wearing this pea coat. You know, it was cold outside. So I went to kneel down. My knee pinned the bottom of my coat to the ground so I couldn't sit back up straight. I had to put my hand against the wall so I could lean and get the jacket out from underneath myself.
Then he looked at me. I realized he was down on one knee on purpose. He got real calm and he took my hand and he said, "I want to spend the rest of my life with you." I was in total shock, even more so than I was on my dad's driveway basketball court when Chip first said, "I love you." "Oh, my goodness," was the only thing I could get out. I was so taken aback and so happy, but so confused. "Chip," I said, kind of giggling and giddy at the whole thing, "babe, why are we doing this in the hallway?" Chip got a funny smile on his face, a smile I'd never seen before, and he said, "Well, knock on the door." We were standing beside an unmarked door in that unmarked hallway, and I could not figure out for the life of me what he was up to. I shook my head and went ahead and knocked, and the door opened. Behind it stood a man who looked like Geppetto from Pinocchio, wearing a leather apron and a magnifying visor on his head. "Welcome to my jewelry shop," the man said. "You're here to design your ring." I just about melted. The shopping center was closed, so we had the whole store to ourselves. The jeweler was a man named Billy Holder who had gone to high school with Chip's dad, and they'd worked this whole thing out in advance. The fact that the selection of the ring tied back to Chip's roots and family history made it all the more special for me. I couldn't get over the fact that Chip had arranged all of this just for me. When did he have the time? How did he keep it all a secret? I basically got the chance to sit and sift through Billy's entire inventory of diamonds and settings and pick my engagement ring right there on the spot.
I gave her the pick of any $80 diamond she wanted.
He's kidding. His budget was actually quite a bit more than $80. We joked about that, though, because my dad had only had $80 to spend on my mom's engagement ring, and she'd loved it anyway. But as soon as they could afford it, she upgraded. But I was so happy. I think I would have been happy with an $80 ring if that was all Chip could afford.
Sure, if you were the one to pick it out. Even back then, I was smart enough to know that you were very opinionated. If I'd gone and picked out the ring myself, I could literally have seen you going, "Hey, I really do love you, and you and I are going to work out fine, but there is no way that's the ring that I'm going to wear."
Oh, and just to clarify about my answer to Chip, at some point after saying, "Oh my goodness," I did say yes. Chip said his mom had loaned him some money, so I was able to get something really special. We didn't have tens of thousands of dollars to spend, and thankfully we weren't buying diamonds in Beverly Hills. I was able to pick out a nice round diamond and a beautiful antique-looking platinum setting. I had a blast sitting there with Billy, designing the perfect ring. Chip just sat there, patiently observing every second of it. After he finished designing, Billy said he would need some time to work on the ring, so he gave me a substitute to wear for the time being, just for fun. It was a great, big, gaudy, fake diamond that he put together so I'd have something to show off to my friends and family. "Your parents are going to go crazy wondering how much money you spent on this," Billy said to Chip with a laugh. There was no private concert that night, but Chip did have more in store for me. From Billy's shop, we drove over to this cute little Archer City hotel for dinner. My parents, my little sister, Chip's parents, and his sister were all there waiting to celebrate our engagement with us. There were all sorts of hugs and tears of joy that made that night the most perfect night ever, and of course they were all taken aback by the size of my diamond. It's funny to me that even back then, they all seemed to realize that a flashy ring just wasn't my style. They expected to see me wearing something a little subtler, a little smaller, a little more classic maybe. But we strung them along for a good long while, and we all had a good laugh when Chip finally revealed that the ring was fake. 12 years later, we had the opportunity to invite Billy Holder out to the farm for our anniversary party. Chip surprised me that night with a 12-year anniversary strand of pearls that Billy hand-delivered to me, and we had the cameras there to capture the whole moment. It aired as part of our third season. But what the cameras didn't show was the moment we went back to the farm and found Billy sitting on my front porch holding a selection of diamonds on the black velvet tray. "Chip wants you to upgrade," he said to me. "My engagement ring?" I said. "Yes, he knows you love the setting, but he wants you to be able to pick out a better diamond like your mom did."
That first diamond was beautiful, but it was really simple in nature. It was all I could afford back then, but at this point I really wanted to do something nicer. You know, something bigger. So I told Billy to bring me some options so we could replace it with something else. I thought of it as an investment of sorts. I really wanted this one to be perfect.
So Billy showed me all these beautiful diamonds and told me I could have my pick. That's supposed to be every girl's dream, right? But I looked at him in the eye and I said, "I'm sorry, but no. This is the original diamond I picked and it's perfect just the way it is." It wasn't a perfect diamond, but it was perfect for me. I felt bad that Billy wasn't going to make the big sale he was hoping for that day, but I don't ever want to replace that diamond or that ring. To me, my ring is part of our story. If I looked down at my hand and saw a more expensive diamond in that setting, it somehow wouldn't fit. I would know that we couldn't have afforded that diamond back when we first got engaged. The story wouldn't add up. But this ring, with this diamond, the one I wear every day, this ring fits. When I look at it, I remember picking out that very diamond on the night of our engagement and looking at it through the little magnifier. I think about the look on Chip's face when he looked up at me in the hallway, and inevitably, I can't stop myself from thinking of where it led us 6 months later. Our wedding. 3. Something old, something new. Sometimes I think if I were to do my wedding today, I would do things differently. With everything I've learned, the places I've gone, the design ideas I've seen, I would want to include all sorts of details that I would never have imagined back then. But then I flip open our wedding album and see the smiling faces of the people we love all gathered in that place where we chose to celebrate our special day together. And just as with my engagement ring, any desire for something different or fancier melts away. Our wedding was perfect just the way it was. Everything we cared about was exactly the way we wanted. When I look back, I realize I wouldn't change a single thing. Chip and I got married here in Waco on May 31st, 2003 at the Earl Harrison House, a historic mansion that looks an awful lot like the place where we had our first date, a stately manor with grand pillars and a gorgeous garden. We actually chose the location primarily because of its park-like setting. We wanted an outdoor wedding and the gardens there were filled with roses. The place was completely covered in flowers, climbing high on grand arbors that our guests would walk under. The setting was so beautiful, just the way it was. I didn't need much of a budget for flowers. I love magnolias even back then, before the shop came along, so we cut individual magnolia leaves for our guests to use as fans. My parents had sat us down shortly after we announced our engagement and made us an offer. They'd been married on the steps of a courthouse, and with that in mind, they'd see they were going to give us a certain amount of money as an upfront wedding gift. We could use that money for whatever we wanted, to throw a nicer wedding than we could afford on our own, although anything would have been more than the wedding we could afford on our own at that point, or to throw a simple wedding and use that money on a down payment for a home or a honeymoon or whatever we chose. Chip and I decided that we would use that money for the wedding. Since our plan was to move into one of his soon-to-be-vacated student rental houses on 3rd Street for the summer, we didn't need extra for a down payment, and Chip's parents had been kind enough to take care of the honeymoon, so we were set. I had no desire for a high-priced designer dress, so I went out shopping with my mom and found one off the rack for about $500. Just a simple, white, Cinderella-looking dress with a lace-up back, narrow at the waist and then flowing out through the skirt. Chip and his groomsmen wore rented tuxedos from the mall. We weren't interested in capturing the latest trends or trying to impress anybody. We just wanted it to be beautiful, and the best way I knew to do that was to stick to a classic, timeless look, so black and white attire with red roses was the palette we chose. Plus, we knew all of those beautiful white roses in the Harrison House Gardens would give us the perfect backdrop we dreamed of. The day before the wedding, we went over to the property for the rehearsal, and I just about died. The estate had pruned all of the roses. They were gone. Every last one of them. There was nothing there but empty stems. The arbors, the arch over the altar, everything was just leaves and thorns. Sadly, it just happened to be the time of year to prune the roses. It was a professionally kept garden, like an arboretum, and the time had come. I mean, I think they could have waited an extra day or two knowing they had a wedding that weekend, but it was too late to argue. In a last-minute attempt to save the scene, we scrambled to our parents to ask for a flower budget. We bought hundreds and hundreds of white roses and stuck them in bunches all over the arbors and barren bushes, doing our best to fill in a million holes and make it look like the real roses were still there. When I look at pictures now, it may be obvious that those roses had been stuck in by hand, but that wasn't the point. It was honestly almost better that all of our closest friends and family had come together at the last minute and tried to turn this venue back into the place we'd been dreaming about. It really was perfect. Perfect for us. And part of the reason for that is we broke tradition in some ways. For example, Chip insisted that his dog Shiner be in the wedding. We haven't mentioned Chip's dog yet, but that mutt was Chip's best friend. I still swear to this day that he loved that dog more than he loved me. My bridesmaids weren't crazy about the idea of Shiner being a member of the wedding party, but Chip wouldn't budge.